I'm going to go through by presenting a series of mystery objects. I've got three mystery things which I'm going to base my talk around. I thought it would be a nice way in. The first thing is what all good humanists start with, a primary source document. Does anyone know what this is? It's a map of Edinburgh. There were some people in the audience will know it's a map of Edinburgh because I tweeted quite a lot about this map of Edinburgh a few weeks ago. In 1776, Edinburgh had a competition. They just drained the North Loch under the castle and they needed a new town built across from where the castle is. And they had a public competition for that. There were many entries. There was a monetary prize. Someone who was 26 called James Craig won this. And his, really quite rubbish, drawing is, here it is, New Plan of Edinburgh, based on the Union Jack flag. The reason this won, it is basically the reason it won is because here was Edinburgh just after the Union of the Crown, just after the Union Jack flag had been adopted across the UK, and he thought, wouldn't it be nice if the capital city of Scotland has as its new street plan the Union Jack flag to show how wonderful we all are and how we all get along. And he won the prize. Here's a picture here. I bring this up because crowdsourcing isn't anything new, okay? Saying we've got a problem and we need help from the wider community is nothing new at all. There is crowdsourcing in fairy tales. Who can rid Hamlin of these rats? Okay? There's crowdsourcing in the Bible. Daniel chapter 5, and the king spake and said, bring me the astrologers, bring me the Chaldeans, and bring me the soothsayers, and whoever can read these documents and show me the meaning therein shall be clothed in scarlet and shall have gold around his neck. It's not new. We ask people for help. We try to get people involved. But this is where technology comes in. And in the history of involving amateurs and general society into tasks has been matched by great advances in technology. The first major crowdsourcing thing was in the mid-19th century for astronomy. Why? Because cheap telescopes became available and people could, very cheap, Lou's shaking his head, and could, there was widespread societies which encouraged people to send in their astronomical readings, and we understood much more about astronomy, and astronomy actually became a science. Binoculars meant that ornithology became a proper science and the study of birds. In the 1970s, oral history and linguistics, especially vulgar language, became a proper study of field. Why? What technology drove that in the 1970s? Anyone?
Tape recorders.
Tape recorders, cassette players. And here we arrive in 2011, and then we have the most major disruptive technology that has been for a while, internet technologies, which allows us to reach one to many and encourage people to join in many to one and to help solve problems. Now, cultural heritage industries have been quick to adopt this and jump on the bandwagon, and it is a wee bit of a bandwagon, and I'm delighted to not be in the Jeremy Bentham room where we were supposed to be to talk about Jeremy Bentham. If you haven't seen old Jezza, as you like to call him, he sits in the, just near where we were at Lucas Restaurant further along in, what's that called? South Cloisters. And he sits in his box there. He's opened up in the morning. He's put to bed at night. Jeremy Bentham, huge, huge influence on UCL and the founding of UCL. He was writing and working at his peak at the same time as the whole thing was going on in Edinburgh. You know, the crowds and the flag and the new street design. It's the same time period where he was really getting into things and talking about to reorganise society. And those of you who know me will know that I've been heavily involved in a project called Transcribe Bentham, which is based at UCL, which is a crowdsourcing project. What we've done is we built an interface using MediaWiki, and we scanned in only about 2,000 documents. There's another 20,000 that need scanned in, and we've got funding for it to do another 10,000. We've put them online, and we've encouraged the wider community to transcribe them for us. Now, transcription is a really hard thing to do. Transcription is not an easy thing to do. Reading someone's handwriting, you can zoom in and you can see stuff and you can kind of use magnifying glasses, but it's not an easy exercise. Crowdsourcing tasks vary from some Galaxy Zoo stuff. Is this galaxy round or oblong? to, can you read this handwriting? Can you tell us what's in these documents? There's a huge spectrum of tasks which can be used for crowdsourcing. What we do behind the scenes, we use MediaWiki that was taken off the shelf just because we had an aggressive development schedule. We had a month to get this all up. It was only a year funding, so we had a month to develop the tech to get this live. We use MediaWiki, a wiki-based thing, put a skin on the front of it, and we people can put in their transcriptions, and we behind the scenes have nice TEI, XML, everything's nicely marked up, so we can then dump all this into the university catalogue so it's searchable. And we can see corrections, things crossed out, other things we're not sure of, people can interact, there's pages associated to each document, people can argue about what it says. It's a very, very interesting attempt at reaching out to the wider audience. How successful has it been? Well, we're in the reporting phase of that just now. There's some interesting things to show, like a massive jump here in the January of 2011, a massive jump of people signing up and people transcribing. That's because the New York Times did an article about transcribing. But we have seen a similar spike this week. We were in the Sunday Times in the UK last Sunday. So old media things have a huge effect on uptake of all this. And there's lots of interesting things to say about users and reaching out to users in crowdsourcing. We might have been broadcasting one to many, but actually most of the transcriptions have been done by three or four people. We have one particular person who wants to do one every day. Fair enough, she has done more than half of the transcriptions we've done. We've done nearly 2,000 documents now, which is about the same as you would have got if you paid a researcher full time to transcribe documents for a year. So the cost of, we haven't done more than the crowdsourcing actually pays for. And I can talk about transcribing for a long time, but the whole point is, this is a means to set a task, to ask help, to get people to do stuff. How does this relate to digital humanities? If my slide would actually go forward, I could tell you. No. Nope. Computers, eh? Broken. Yes. So we're going to taskify stuff. If we want to use crowdsourcing while we're making this wonderful history or histories of digital humanities, what tasks are we going to ask people to do? And don't dare tell me you're going to set up a wiki. Oh yeah, we'll set up a wiki and then we're going to fill it in and then it'll all get resolved. And no one will do it unless it's a defined task. And that's been the great failure of most wiki spaces, not the name of the firm, but the wiki spaces, like the general wiki sphere. They're not taskified enough, they're not specific enough. You can't just put up a wiki and expect people to fill it in. You have to say what exactly you want people to contribute, what's the reward for contributing as well. And a lot of crowdsourcing things have a reward mechanism built in, so people get hooked and they want to do more. For TranscribeBentham, you can go through different levels of expertise and you get different coloured stars. It's the same with eBay, you know, you get different coloured stars, and same with if you work at McDonald's, but let's not go there. but there's no point in just putting up a wiki and expecting the community to pile in and actually do it for us. We have to taskify. If we want to do crowdsourcing, you have to taskify it. Yes. What can be taskified? As Laura just said, let's organise something where we scan in as many book covers as possible from Humanities Computing and put up something like that. That would be, you know, the Flickr group, it could be a fun thing to do. It wouldn't be hard to necessarily organise that, but it's finding a way, it's finding and finding an absolute thing that you want people to do. Most crowdsourcing things work best when it's a specific, easy task. I mentioned Galaxy Zoo earlier, and is the galaxy round or oblong? So people are searching through millions of images of galaxies and telling them there's three different things you can choose. They've had millions of people contribute, clicking on two or three images, sorting through vast amounts of astrological data, astronomical data, to sort through stuff that computers can't do, but the human eye can, and they have outsourced that through crowdsourcing, and it has worked. TranscribeBentham has only had 2,000 documents read by about 1,000 people because it's a much more complicated task. And people are realising that the more complex task it is, the harder it is to crowdsource. And actually some interesting projects are starting now where they are already saying that they only want 200 people. They're actually kind of sifting through the crowd before they let them wild on their data set and saying, yeah, come people, sign up to sort of help sort through our stuff, but we're only going to have 200 people do it and you've got to actually apply. My mind's got a blank as to what that is, but I'll think about it and I'll get back to you. So I'm going to show you a second mystery object. I'll give you a second to read through it. Yes. Is TI crap or what? It's a bit question, isn't it? With what's been happening recently. This I stole and then asked permission to use from Lou's Facebook page. Lou put it up after the recent spat about what the TI is showing and what's happening. This is a real document that I don't know anything about it. We put it on his page and it was really funny. And it struck me that this is exactly the type of thing we're going to run into when we're talking about the history of digital humanities, humanities computing. When we're talking about the history of any academic discipline, there is ephemera attached to the discipline which tells you an awful lot about who was there, who were the protagonists, the relationships between them, and what they were up to. Now, I'm sure there wasn't a real tag team wrestling match, was there? Is there four guys?
I know.
We need to think about ephemera, and ephemera is really, really important. There's been, I was going to say hundreds of studies, but actually there's been three studies that have been published about ephemera and digital ephemera and identity in academia. When you walk into an academic's office and you don't know what subject you're studying, you can generally figure it out pretty darn quick. Why? All this ephemera that they've got about. They've got the mugs from the conferences, they've got the umbrellas, they've got the conference bags, they've got this, that, and the next. And you can tell the tribe, the academic tribe that people belong to. There's a lot of ephemera. Where does this fit into the kind of hidden history stuff? I think that's very important. And collecting ephemera from digital humanities, humanities computing, let's have slides with every single conference back from the last 20 years. Let's have slides from every single conference proceeding, you know, all that kind of thing. Today I was sorting out my bag here, I haven't been to work for a year. I needed an umbrella, it's going to rain in London, and the only umbrella I could find is from digital humanities. Oh gosh, DMHA 192, whatever, blah. But I've got in my bag, it's an umbrella from digital humanities. I thought I could bring that in the lecture, and I thought that was going to be unlucky to put it up in a lecture. So I won't. But I've got that with me. But those type of things really identify people. It's important. Second thing about this, I know who Lou is. Hi, Lou. I know who Michael Iceberg McCree is. He's not here today. I don't actually know who Mark Olson is. I don't think. Would I know if I saw him? Am I just having mummy brain?
Yeah.
Oh, Chicago.
How can you not know
Mark Olson?
Well, like
what
I say.
Oh.
Big talk guy with curly brain hair.
Okay. All right. Chicago. See, we need to ask other people to help us to figure out these things. And here we have Paul the Fury 40. Paul. You guys don't have the opportunity to meet Paul because he's no longer with us. This also brings up something. Willard mentioned earlier that we need to have some distance between us and the past, but when there's distance between us and the past, there's things that are lost. I only had the pleasure to have a proper conversation with Paul once, and it was in Victoria, in LSEACH 2000. There was some mix-up, which I can't remember, for the committee meetings, and Edward and me and Paul were sitting in the committee meeting room waiting for the committee meeting to start, and no one else turned up. And we were there, and there was people running about behind the scenes staring out in the air. And so we sat with Paul for maybe 2 hours, just chatting, and he started to tell us some stories about his early days as humanities computing. And he told us this very great story about punch cards, and how he put, I can't even remember the text, Edward, do you remember the text that he was working on?
I can't remember.
But it was just huge text, and he spent a year, he spent a year putting it on punch cards so that he could take it to the university computer and he could put it into the machine and press the button and do that. And the night before he got a slot of time on the computer, and he had to book it months and months and months in advance. So he got the slot of time, got his boxes all nicely laid out, his punch cards, and he said, you drew a big V on all of them to make sure that if they fell out of the box, you'd be able to put them back in order. So he's walking from his car to the place. The snow had just started to fall. And he trips and falls. And not only are the things out of order, but they're wet. And he had to go back and spend another year putting this text in on punch cards and start over again. Now, if that isn't a hidden history story, I don't know what is. And it strikes me that you're going to have to reach out to the community and ask for the stories, the hidden history stories, as well as the, in 1908 this happened, and in 1920 blah this happened. No, what we're actually looking for are the stories. I know another one from Roy Wisby. Roy, I don't know, it's Wisby, what's the Wisby
company? Yes, last time I heard.
Yeah. Roy Wisby, he was at Cambridge. He was using the first computer at Cambridge to do digital maps. And he told me a fantastic story over dinner where when he decommissioned the first computer at Cambridge, it's a valve computer, right? It had these analog valves. And they broke up the machine, but rather than throw out all the analog valves, they made like little trophies out of them, and they gave them all to all the people that worked in the computer. Isn't that lovely? But then he said, all his friends were dying, and they were clearing out their offices, and they didn't even know what to do with the valves. They didn't want to throw it out. So people were sending him them back. He was gathering this computer back again in his office. He's going to know what to do with it. I've got all these valves. And I thought, isn't that a story we want to know? Isn't that a story we want to hear? We might want to talk to Roy and actually verify it. But I thought, it says something about the transience of time and, you know, all that kind of thing. But it's important that we connect with people, we connect with the older generation, and we capture these stories. We make sure that we know these type of things. That's the interesting things that you remember. I'm rubbish at remembering off the top of my head whether it was 1776 or 1777 that the map of Scotland was done, but that is the stories that tells a lot about what computing was like and what people were like. Third, mystery object. Who knows what this is?
That's a chair made by what do you call them? Wood choppers in Canada. Among digital humanities sculptures, art.
2005.
Yeah. And Donna got one, and Harold got one, and like the presidents of the associations got one.
And here's Lorna accepting her chair. You had to do some crazy chopping thing to win it, didn't you? You had to do some crazy
rocking thing. Actually.
Yeah, sorry, she said she's put that out of her mind forever.
There were chainsaws being thrown.
No, there was axes thrown.
Axes thrown, that's right, there were axes thrown.
But that
thrown.
Was hefted by a chainsaw.
It was live, in the middle of the conference dinner. Someone carved a tree with
nails, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, what happened was, sorry to interrupt, but there were these guys with chainsaws carving these things, and they stood there still wielding the chainsaws, and they said, "And would Lorna Hughes and Harold Short please come forward?"
And you look very scared to see the show.
It's my trepidation.
Well, this again to me stands for this kind of the links between people, the stories around objects. But isn't the chair a delicious metaphor for complex objects, and a complex object in digital humanities? Because we don't just make nice text that we printed out and someone can scan and put on Facebook. Complex objects in digital humanities is part of the history, the programs, the stuff that doesn't work anymore. What are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about the technology behind things? You know, that's a really important thing that we need to look at when we're looking at a history at this period, the technology, the things we built, the things that don't work anymore. But how do we describe that? How do we describe the complex objects from our past? This is the chair now, as of last week. It took me some tracking down. Ray Siemens has it on his back porch in nice temperate Victoria. He said he was looking after it for Lorna for an occasion such as this, where it could be filled out and used to talk about the history of digital humanities. So thank you, little chair. But I think it really is important to think about how we deal with complex objects, as well as ephemera, and as well as talking about events in the discipline, how we deal with the complex objects which have resulted from digital humanities scholarship, and how they play their part in the history, how we can describe that, and how we can talk about. Maybe I'm just looking for a more interesting history of computing science, really, from our point of view. But it has to exist, and there are problems therein. So we're back to our map of Edinburgh, the original, or one of the original kind of main crowdsourced things. Anyone who's been to Edinburgh knows that it doesn't look like this. Anyone got any idea why? Can you imagine trying to go to IKEA and get furniture for those pointy rooms? Ooh, look at my kitchen, this apex is 12 degrees, and the stairs are so long. Those buildings? And when they came to draw it up, they're like, do you know what? It's nice theory, this Union of the Clouds and all. Nice map, put the map, but actually, it's never going to work. And they replaced it with a grid system, the traditional grid system, which, you know, is austere and Georgian and wonderful when you actually go to see it and all. The interesting thing about this for me was that this map has bugged me for a long time. as part of my art history degree, we did a course in architecture. They talked about the architecture of the new town in Edinburgh a lot. We went to see it, and everyone talked about the original street plan being a Union Jack, but no one could show me a slide of it. If you look at Wikipedia and this entry about Edinburgh, they say the original street plan was this Union Jack, and when they came to build it, the buildings were all pointy. There isn't a link to where this is. If you look at the book, Georgian History of the Architecture of Edinburgh, I know, because I spent like 3 weeks looking for this, going, you know, where is this? Where, there must be something that exists if everyone's all saying that. So eventually, I turned to the hive mind. I turned to Twitter and I said, oi, come on, people, does anyone know anything about this? Someone knew someone who put me in touch on Twitter with the head of the National Library of Scotland and one of the curators there, who said, oh yes, the document you're looking for is a plan of Edinburgh and places adjacent. Now, I never had found that in years and years of searching. That's what the document's called. There's only one left. This is the original text. It's kind of drawn on. I'm sure there was other plans which were more and more detailed. This is the one thing that's left. It was Twitter that helped me find it. Yes, Lucy, can you say it again? It was Twitter that helped me find it. And it was.
You go to the library first.
I was working from home on maternity leave. I couldn't leave the house. Which is another thing. So it's useful to see that reaching out to the crowd there and reaching out for people is actually, it actually works and it actually helps. But we need to think about what we're doing. We need a roadmap that's going to work. We need a plan that is feasible. If you're going to build crowdsourcing into this project, you need to think very carefully about what you want, what you need, what the community has that we don't know about, what the community can realistically bring to this project and provide, and how you're going to reach that community and talk to people. Otherwise, it just won't work. Thanks very much.